He would never have dropped an order because of his hands. They were extraordinary, absurdly disproportionate in size and crushing in strength. It had to be some strange fluke of genetics and a fierce training regime. Maybe he squeezed rocks while running or hung from the rafters by his fingers while he slept. By mid-December, day after day, our Afghan allies expanded their influence, if not control, over the country. The Taliban and AQ were in panic disarray. We knew that UBL and other leaders were on the run, especially after their catastrophic defeat at Tora Bora. We must redouble our efforts against fleeing Al-Qaeda leaders now that we have secured most geographic objectives, I ordered during our staff meeting. Tell our teams that we need any and all intelligence available on UBL and his subordinate commanders. We have killed his number three, Mohammed Atef, and others, but I want them all. One of our HQS analysts responded, Taliban intelligence chief Qari Ahmadullah sent a message via intermediaries that he wants to talk. How should we respond? We talk. If he can give us AQ leaders, we will cut a deal, I said. There was no doubt in my mind. AQ was America's enemy. The Taliban were local lackeys, either an obstacle in our way or a means to get to AQ. Ahmadullah had signaled his desire to talk at various times, including in July that year, but there were always conditions. He always wanted far more than he deserved, and, more important, far more than U.S. interests warranted. He could not be trusted. I knew that, but I would give him a chance. I would give him a very simple choice. Who is working the contact? I asked. Tony. Good. I discussed the operational variables with my HQS team, and I gave approval for Tony to meet directly with Ahmadullah, contingent on a review of the security situation and Tony's exfiltration plans. I parsed Tony's mission into three outcomes. First preference, secure Ahmadullah's complete cooperation. He will need to demonstrate this somehow in the first meeting. If we are sure that we can run him in place as a controlled asset, do it. If he delivers UBL and or other key AQ leaders, we will reward him. Second preference, capture him and interrogate. Third, if we can't grab him because he resists, Tony should use whatever force is required to protect his team and himself. In other words, if he must, kill him. The next day I briefed Kofor, Director Tenet, and all those at the daily 1700 hours meeting held in the director's conference room on the 7th floor. I did not ask approval. I just outlined the orders and the possible outcomes as I had to my staff. Kofor was impassive. His hulking presence alone could intimidate naysayers. He said nothing. He didn't have to. Tenet chewed on a mangled wet cigar. No objection, no discussion. I never mentioned other possible outcomes. Tony and his team could be captured, tortured, and then killed while being videotaped for an AQ internet show. Or, more mercifully, they could die in a firefight. The meeting was set in a contested area in Ghazni province. It was no man's land. With only three other U.S. operatives and a dozen Afghan escorts, Tony led his team overland, first by vehicle and then by foot, to the rendezvous site in a nondescript house. There was no UAV Predator or other air cover. We did not have enough air assets. They were on their own. Ahmadullah did not show. He sent a subordinate who was well informed, but failed to provide useful intelligence. Moreover, he had no authority to deal. Nor did he seem inclined to work as a CIA penetration of the Taliban. He was following his boss's orders, assessing us, buying time, and falling far short of the outlined expectations for the meeting. Tony did not call for guidance. He knew his mission. He exercised good judgment and embraced the responsibility of leadership expected of him. Tony gave the signal. He and his team overpowered the Taliban contingent. They bound and gagged them and left them on the hut floor. They rolled Amadullah's representative into a carpet. In broad daylight, they walked out of the house and down the road with the extra bulky carpet under their arms. They made it to the pre-designated LZ. After a gut-wrenching delay, a helicopter picked them up. Within 24 hours of his capture, the Taliban prisoner revealed AQ and Taliban command posts and other positions along the Pakistan border. Based on this intelligence, confirmed by other sources, including our UAVs, we requested an airstrike. U.S. aircraft transformed these enemy sites into a mix of rubble, dust, flesh, and bone. Scores of AQ and Taliban died. During the bombing, the Predator picked up one individual fleeing on foot. He made it to a motorbike and tried to escape. He did not get far. He disappeared in a fiery blast. We watched on the video monitor. We later learned the fleeing man was Taliban intelligence chief Amadullah. He should have taken our offer. Pride, prestige, and honor. Much like the collection of intelligence, which requires carrots and sticks, covert action is best employed with a comprehensive approach. Covert action implementers should be willing partners, but often they need encouragement. In our effort to recruit tribal militia leaders to our cause, we worked jointly with our Afghan allies. They had regular communication with their countrymen, even those on the Taliban side. The accurate and extensive bombing campaign had recalibrated the perceptions of many uncertain Afghan tribal leaders. Some rallied to our cause on their own accord. Others remained ambivalent. We specifically targeted those who rejected our overtures. We then asked their nearby Taliban commanders, who had often witnessed their colleagues' demise, death or reward. They almost always accepted the latter. We demanded more than just their word. We explained that only a demonstration of their lethal intent against AQ would seal the deal. They must spy for us, turn their guns on their AQ comrades, and even betray other Taliban leaders. Those Taliban leaders who accepted our offer and fought with us boosted not only their chances of survival, but also their material benefits. This rolling sequence of attack, intimidation, recruitment, victory, and reward accelerated our advances during late 2001. In many cases, however, fear is trumped by honor, pride, and prestige on the battlefield. Thucydides makes that point in his classic text, History of the Peloponnesian War. This was manifest in our efforts to recruit tribal armies throughout the conflict, perhaps best demonstrated by the logic behind the 1.69 million pounds of arms, ammunition, food, clothing, blankets, and medical supplies dropped by parachute in 110 bundles to 41 locations from mid-October to mid-December 2001. The CIA and U.S. Air Force, working in concert, delivered each package customized to the needs and preferences of our Afghan partners, including those prospective allies. With winter fast approaching, Afghan tribal leaders needed to protect their people with shelter, clothing, and food. Without that, how could they leave them to go fight? After their requests to the CIA officers, within 48 to 72 hours, these supplies were falling from the sky. Not only did we respond to their material needs, we did so in a manner that enhanced their leadership position. We gave them what they wanted, and their tribe knew it. We also provided the weapons and intelligence, matched with air power, that enabled them to exercise their warrior ethos. They could fight the foreign AQ invaders who had hijacked their government. The CIA respected our Afghan allies and delivered as promised. Trust and the ability to enhance Allied leaders' standing among their people, helping them burnish their pride, honor, and prestige, can prove more powerful than any amount of munitions. The orchestration of power, hard and soft, in Afghanistan eroded the Taliban's center of gravity, which rested in the minds of tribal leaders. As we suborned the Taliban, unhinged their alliances, and turned tribal armies against them, we further exposed Al-Qaeda to our onslaught. Tora Bora. By late November, we knew UBL and his leadership cohort had retreated from Jalalabad toward the Pakistan border, perhaps to their high mountain refuge of Tora Bora. Burnson, now in Kabul, briefed me by phone every day on Jawbreaker's progress. He had already sent his deputy, John, to establish a base in